I'm John Simpson, Chief Editor of the Oxford English Dictionary. I'm here talking to Simon Winchester, who's the author of The Professor and the Madman, both about the writing of his book and the making of the Oxford English Dictionary. Simon, The Professor and the Madman tells a fascinating story. How did you come across it in the first place?
Well, you're probably aware, John, there's a book by Jonathan Green called Chasing the Sun, which is a history of dictionary making, and I was actually reading this book in the bath one winter's day about 2 years ago, and there was a footnote which said, in a rather offhand way, that of course readers will be familiar with the extraordinary story of Dr. W.C. Minor, the American lunatic murderer who was imprisoned in Broadmoor and became a prolific contributor to the OED. I remember vividly sitting up in the bath and saying, I've never heard of this story. And I rang one person in your office, Elizabeth Knowles, who you'll know well, I dare say, and said, Elizabeth, do you know anything? Well, first of all, I apologised and said it's rather vulgar. I'm calling you from my bath in America. But do you know anything about this chap called W.C. Minor? And she said, well, as a matter of fact, I probably know rather more about him than most people because I wrote a paper about him for a journal, a quarterly, I think, published in Madison, Wisconsin, called Dictionaries. And if you like, if you get out of the bath, I'll fax it to you and you can read it when you're toweling yourself dry. And so she did, and I read it, and I thought, if I can get access to the Broadmoor files on this man, then perhaps there's rather a good book to be written.
Was that a difficult thing to do? Because you must have had access to all sorts of out-of-the-way medical records only held in Broadmoor. Did they give you access easily?
Well, I thought it would be terribly difficult. He was also imprisoned for quite a long time in St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C. And what I thought would happen was, because Americans are so free with information and the British are so, as you'll well know, traditionally rather guarded with it, that it would be very easy to get the American information on him, but very difficult to get the Broadmoor information. In fact, quite the reverse happened. Broadmoor, for all sorts of reasons, is under attack by the British press at the moment. And when they had someone who was at least purporting to be a historian coming along and saying, I'd like to write about Broadmoor of 150 years ago, they said, that's actually rather a good idea. And they opened up their files, and I was able to go many, many times to Broadmoor to have a look at the thousands and thousands of pages that are his medical papers. St. Elizabeth's, by contrast, in Washington, is now under the control of the District of Columbia government, which is not a government with a particularly happy recent record, and they didn't want to give me the papers at all, and I nearly had to sue to get the papers, and it might have cost a great deal of money and taken a lot of time, but in fact, it turned out they were all available through the internet, and so a couple of clicks on the button and my Visa card number, and they all arrived in a FedEx package the next day. So, generally speaking, the papers were quite easy to get.
You must have been surprised at the book's popularity. Did it take you by surprise, what do you think it is about the book that intrigues readers and captures their imagination?
Well, the first thing, I'm totally astonished by the success of the book because, not a single one of my books has ever done well. Very few, I think, have ever earned out their advances. But this one suddenly took off after a very kind review written in the New York Times that was published on Labor Day 1998, a Labor Day that happened to be a rainy day, and New Yorkers stayed at home instead of blazing around on the beach, and read the paper and read the review, and obviously a large number of them thought they'd buy it, and then word of mouth took over. But as to why it became so successful, well, I think, I'm sure you'd agree that the simple story of murder and redemption of W.C. Minor's character through his work for the OED is quite a good story, but I think there's another agenda in here. I think that people like, and this very much plays into your hand, I think, like the rituals of lexicography. They find it romantic. They find the story of dictionary making something that, if they can get to it painlessly, and rather through the story of a murder and this American Civil War and all the other elements of this book, they find it an agreeable thing to do, to learn about lexicography in a somewhat romantic way. And that's my only explanation for the way the book is done.
Why do you think Dr. Minor is particularly drawn towards the dictionary?
Well, probably you can answer that better than I, and maybe you've got some views on it, but I think, he clearly was a deeply mad man, and maybe the soothing rituals of lexicography, the calm and the attention to detail and the long hours, and somehow appeal to someone who, in other hours of the night, because it was the night time that his madness was most obvious, it becomes a soothing ritual. You tell me, what's it like as a lexicographer? Is it a very meticulous, time-consuming kind of work that soothes you in a way?
Yes, you, you paint a very bleak picture of lexicographers. It's certainly the case that Dr. Minor contributed to the OED, but I think some people have the impression that he also edited the dictionary.
Well, we ought to get that straight.
Well, I think it's probably worth straightening out the fact that the material he supplied was some of the raw material from which the editors analysed the language. And so there was a filter before the material was actually published and the definitions were written by the editorial staff. Yes, it is meticulous work. I used to say it requires a lot of common sense as well. I think in his lucid hours, he probably had a very analytical mind. You do need to be analytical to analyse the raw material of the language, which is the quotation text that readers like Dr. Minor and others contributed in the 19th century in their thousands.
How did you get into this whole business in the first place? Well, did you read English at Oxford? Is that how it started?
I've always been fascinated with words, and when I read English, English literature. Although I was doing a literature course, I was trying to immerse myself, I suppose, in Old English and Middle English and Old Norse. I couldn't see the point of learning Old English if you couldn't read the Icelandic Old Norse sagas. So I got involved in that.
So can you do that? You can read the sagas in Old Norse,
well,
can you?
One wants to be able to, doesn't
well,
one?
Can you?
Yeah, I can read them, yeah. I'm not some of the more complicated poetry, because that's a different kettle of fish altogether.
And then
but
how
yeah,
did,
the sagas are fantastic.
How did you get involved in the dictionary itself?
Well, I mean, simply by the traditional means of seeing an advertisement for, you know, do you want to become an assistant editor on the Oxford English Dictionary? And I thought, well, I don't want to become a teacher. Research sounds the sort of thing I'd like to do, and here's an opportunity. So I turned up for interview and got the job, and that was 25 years ago or so. And we do find that when people start working on the dictionary, they either last 6 months because, you know, they go up in smoke and they can't stand it and they move to be an accountant or a lawyer or something sensible, or they just get fascinated by it and continue, you know, maybe for the rest of their lives. I mean, that's what Dr. Minor did, that's what Dr. Murray did, that's what all the old contributors to the OED did, and we've got many readers today who have been associated with us all the time I've been at the dictionary.
What was your first, the first couple of years, what kind of things were you doing?
Oh, actually, one of the nice things about working on the OED is that you do feel that you're contributing straight away to the final product. The first thing I did was like Dr. Minor, I was given a book to read and to read it against the dictionary, looking for words that weren't in the dictionary and maybe should be, or good examples of words that were already in the dictionary that could be used in future to supplement the record. I should point out that the Oxford English Dictionary, as you know, doesn't just have definitions and etymologies, but also has a fairly comprehensive record of a word's use from written sources from the earliest time that we've been able to find a record of the word in English down to either the present day or when the word dropped out of use. And those were the quotations that Dr. Minor was supplying, mainly from 16th and 17th century sources.
Well, that raises an interesting point. When you started your work 25 years ago, were you looking for words that were illustrative of the first use of words that were already in the dictionary, or were you looking at modern books for the first use of modern words?
Now, when I started working, we were working on what was called a supplement to the Oxford English Dictionary, and that was principally 19th and 20th century additions to the language. So I was reading a book by a man called Metz on the language of film, I think. So it was mainly 20th century words, film words, that sort of thing. That work continued on the supplement to the OED until the 1980s, and at that point we expanded, broadened backwards in time again to pick up historical predatings of the dictionary, which is what we're engaged on now. Nowadays, the comprehensive revision of the OED that we're working on involves reading material and analysing material back from the Anglo-Saxon period up to the present day, which is a fascinating biography of every word, really.
The OED, in writing these biographies of individual words, has considerable and justified pride in claiming, in most cases, to have found the quotation that shows the first ever written use of most words. But sometimes you're wrong. Sometimes I believe the Germans are rather keen on showing that they can find an even earlier example in the written record. Does that irk you that you don't always get it right?
No, because if you go into, say, the Library of Congress, or if you go into the British Library and look at all the books that they have on the shelves, and then if you get taken down into the stacks or up into the stacks and see all the books that are there, and you think the language isn't just what's published in books, you know you're not going to necessarily capture the first ever instance of any word or sense of a word. And in fact, Sir James Murray, in a famous lecture he gave in 1900 called On the Evolution of Lexicography, stated that he thought that although the work he'd done was as comprehensive as it could have been done at the time, about two-thirds of the words in the OED could be antedated. Earlier examples could be found of them. And that's what we're finding now. I mean, we're finding in revising the dictionary that at least one in every two words we're able to find earlier evidence for. And really, that's just the start. I think as more historical databases become available on computer, as more people become fascinated in reading for the dictionary and reading books as well as just looking online at these big databases, we'll find more and more evidence. So it's fine as far as I'm concerned. It's fascinating. It just focuses the picture much more sharply.
Can you take us back to 25 years ago when you were working on Metz's book on film? Did you dream then that you would be following in the footsteps of Coleridge and Furnival and Murray and all those other people and becoming the editor of this great book one day?
No, not at the time. I mean, I think there were a number of distinguished editors already in the department, and you just saw yourself working away at that level. I don't know for how long. You didn't think about it. It was my first job out of university, and I was a sort of raw graduate, and it was just a fascinating thing to do for a researcher. One of my colleagues went off to become the editor of the Dictionary of Medieval Latin from English Sources, so he then left the department. Another one became a classic lecturer at Oxford, and others left. Time passes, and I don't know. I like the work. I was obviously quite good at it, and it was a great opportunity. Yeah.
Tell me how you think the English language, in the way that the OED deliberately welcomes the idea that English is a flexible, constantly expanding, constantly changing language, but the French, the 40 immortals at the Institute in Paris, take quite a different view and regard French as sanctified and fixed. From your position in this lofty eyrie, how do you regard the two countries' approaches to their languages?
I think it's based principally on the different types of languages they are. I think French has not had a tradition of being influenced by other languages over history. I mean, English, on the other hand, has been invaded by the French, the Norman conquest. We've had empire roots around the world, and so we've had words coming into English from travellers to the former colonies. We've expanded to America, into New Zealand, Australia, etc., etc. So English is really a patchwork language, and therefore is quite receptive to change and is able to accept changes because there isn't a single fixed pattern for English. Whereas French is more of a monolithic language. There's rather less, one doesn't like to use words like sort of purity and things. But on the other hand, that most French words have got a fairly long pedigree in French. Whereas if you look at a sentence of it in modern day English, you'll see, Latin and Greek and French and German and all sorts of other influences. So I think we're in general the English speaking people are in general as a community is more receptive to change maybe than the French Academy is. That doesn't mean that the French people themselves don't change the language, and of course the language does, and it rather like King Canute and the Ways, the language rides roughshod over the Academy, in fact. And people in England in the 18th century, 100 years after the French Academy was set up, wanted to introduce an Academy into England so that the language could be fixed. This was at a time of Augustan purity, etc., in English.
And you would be very much against that, would you not?
Yes, the interesting thing was that although people like Swift and Dryden and Pope introduced this language and put forward proposals for setting up an academy and fixing the language, that Dr. Johnson, when he came to write his dictionary in the middle of the 18th century, started off when he published a plan of the dictionary in 1747 in which he showed he was part of this tradition of wanting to fix the language, that the language had reached a point of perfection, as instanced in the work of the major authors of the previous century.
Someone like Swift, for instance, there were so many words he objected to. The word couldn't. Mm. I mean, could not was fine by Swift, but couldn't, he said, was not English. Mm. But you would, of course, say
it's not,
is English.
It's not English. You can't say it ain't English, can you? and by the time Johnson finished working on his dictionary, working from all these sources that he was amassing and analysing and writing his dictionary, in the final famous introduction to his dictionary, he rejected the idea that you could fix the language in a dictionary, and his dictionary was essentially a statement of what the language was at a particular point in time. And clearly it's moved on since then, and we're trying to record the changes that are happening now, as well as filling in those changes that we've missed in the past. The trouble with being a lexicographer is that you can always be wrong. I mean, you said before, isn't it nice that the OED gives the first recorded evidence for a particular word? We always know that there's probably earlier evidence for a word, and even if there's not written evidence, the word was probably around in spoken language before it was actually printed. I mean, only a small subset of what's actually spoken or thought is actually printed, so you're dealing with a subset of material anyway. But there is an awful lot of it in the libraries. I mean, if we didn't have libraries, where would we be for remembering our culture? And so it's fascinating rooting around in these sources and trying to fill in the picture.
Finding occasionally mice, I gather that in the old Oxford University archives and the slips, they found the tail of a mouse between some of the old slips, but it wasn't filed under M.
No, it's filed under A, I think. I think it was the beginning of the alphabet that the mice got to. No, you find curious things amongst these. We have millions of these index cards or slips in the department. And nowadays, most material is collected electronically, but until about 1990, most of the material came into the department on these index cards. And yeah, you'd find remarkable evidence of people's lives on these cards. I mean, on the one hand, readers used to write them out by hand, so you could sort of tell from how a reader had written a card that day whether they were, you know, not feeling so good, or whether they were hurried, or whether they had to rush out to the shops or something, which you can't necessarily do when you see the equivalent material on a computer screen with just the sort of regular, you know, ABC of the computer alphabet. And also, we had a collection of slips that was donated to the department about 15 years ago from a reader in America who'd spent an awful lot of time reading material about the First World War military slang in America. He read magazines like Stars and Stripes and various other things, and then he expanded into all sorts of other areas of slang. And unfortunately, he died in a house fire, but his slips survived him. And one of our researchers in Washington went to his funeral, because he used to work in the Library of Congress, she used to work in the Library of Congress, they used to meet for coffee sometimes and chat about their word searches. And she met his widow at the funeral, and she said, we must do something with this material. At the moment, it's in a lockup in Maryland, and he would have loved it to have been useful rather than just to remain as a pile of collected material. And so they arranged to send the material over to the OED in Oxford, and 26 cartons of the material arrived after a sort of tempestuous sea crossing. I mean, it's rather like the sort of 19th century stories of material from America. And now it's being incorporated in our files, but within that you have evidence of the man's life. I mean, when they first came, the cartons still, the slips still smelt of a sort of tinge of smoke. And you could actually see he used file dividers, which he made himself by cutting up into squares material from the boxes in which his pipe tobacco came. So you sort of saw all sorts of evidence of the reader's life in the material that came, which you don't necessarily get when you're just looking at material on a computer.
You're still, of course, collecting new words today and collecting quotations today. How are you soliciting material? Because the old idea of an appeal for readers, which James Murray and his predecessors and immediate successors put out and distributed in libraries and bookstores all over the English-speaking world, how do you appeal for volunteers and readers today?
We have a newsletter which is published, and we invite people to send material in to us either by email or by regular post, and people do. We have a combination of readers who are on a paid reading program, which our reading program manager organizes, and we read through various types of literature to collect material there. But I mean, what to some extent, what is most interesting to me is the volunteer readers still that just work away in university libraries, or just getting books out of their local town library, reading obscure 15th century texts and sending us hundreds of citations with a little catchword at the top, which we file it under that word. And when we get to revise that word, then maybe there's a 15th century antedating of a word that we only thought was current from the 16th century. That sort of thing isn't unusual now, because there's an awful lot of social documentation that's been published since the OED's original reading program in the 19th century. The OED has been criticized to some extent for concentrating on the literary classics of the past. That's a little bit untrue to some extent. But since the 19th century, there's been an awful lot of just ordinary journals, commonplace books, diaries, personal reports, the publications of local record societies with wills and little bits of social documentation that give you an insight into the way everyday people lived, rather than how Shakespeare lived or Shakespeare wrote or Milton wrote. And just scanning through that material, reading through that material, gives you a marvellous picture of the way people lived in the centuries in the past.
Who are these volunteers?
Well, some of them are retired university lecturers, some of them are university lecturers, and some of them are just ordinary people living at home who've got an interest in language and a fairly strong analytical ability.
But they're not ordinary people, are they? They're often somewhat, or they were in the past, slightly dotty, slightly obsessive, slightly meticulous.
I think there's a quality of liking to collect things that you can't get away from, probably both in the readers and in many of the lexicographers. The idea of classifying and the fact that if you work long and hard enough, you can form a fairly comprehensive picture of, you know, you can find more or less all the stones in a mosaic and you see the final picture. So yes, I mean, I think people are, it is the sort of thing that you become quite obsessed with, but I'm not sure to the extent that Dr. Minor became obsessed.
In the old days, you used to have parties in Oxford and used to some of the great contributors who, like Minor, but not including Minor, because he couldn't get away to these parties, they would be invited. Do you occasionally hold get-togethers these days?
I think the last main one was when the second edition of the OED was published back in 1989, and we had a number of different parties for readers and contributors and academics who used to review our entries.
It must have been a pretty extraordinary party with a bunch of very dotty people all coming together drinking bad sherry.
Well, I think you have two misconceptions there. First, that all OED assistants and staff readers are mad, and that Oxford produces bad sherry. The second is probably true.
Yes.
It's fascinating for me to meet them. I mean, one's just year after year receiving written communications from them. Some of them write back to me. There's one gentleman in New York who's continually saying to me, "Why do you write such short letters in reply, John?" Finally, about 2 weeks ago, he sent me a letter in which he said, "I've now discovered why, as a lexicographer, you write me such short letters. It's because you don't like to be wrong. And the less you write, the less..." And this is nonsense. It's just that I've got so much to do during the day that I can't really... I mean, I'd love to spend my whole life corresponding to these fascinating readers, but there's just not the time. He's another fascinating example of a reader who... he started off as a cryptographer, so I think probably he's interested in classifying and declassifying and decrypting things and analysing data. He became interested in trying to research the truth about expressions such as the Big Apple or the Great White Way for Broadway. And he certainly, working in the New York Public Library day in, day out, for many years, has sent us an awful lot of material that shows these terms being used earlier than the OED had originally thought. And it's not just the words themselves, it's the story that they throw up. So if you're researching the Big Apple, you know, why Apple, why Big, why in 1910 or 1920 rather than in 1930?
So the answer? Why Big, why Apple?
I can't actually remember the full details. I have an idea that the various jazz venues around America were known as Apples, and New York was a Big Apple because it was a central one. But that I haven't checked that, so I might be wrong. You can't always believe what lexicographers tell you.
It seems to me, in the last few years of the 20th century, that this is a very rich time for the creation of new words. That there seem to be more words being born nowadays than, let's say, there might have been 50 years ago. Is that true, or are words being constantly, are neologisms constantly coming up at a fairly steady rate through the centuries?
I think people always think that their own time is one of the most creative and prolific times for language creation. I think as far as the evidence in the OED is concerned, and we can now tell a bit more about that because we've got the OED on computer and you can run various programs to check on currency at various times in the past, that principally shows that from the record that we have, the period of Shakespeare and the early modern period was a period of great creativity, and also probably the end of the 19th century and the current period now. Although it's difficult for us to analyse the current period terribly easily because words don't get into the OED straight away. So it's easier to have an overview of the language maybe 25 years ago or so, because the word that came up last week, we'll want to gather material for maybe 5 years or so and analyse it before we put it directly into the dictionary.
Well, how do you determine when a word really is a word worthy of inclusion? I was asking this question to your Canadian opposite number the other day, and she said 15 quotations of a word means to her that the word is a word worthy of inclusion. Do you apply such a hard and fast rule?
Well, I don't apply rules. I don't use expressions, I suppose, like a real word and worthy of inclusion. I mean, that's a sort of a quality judgment which we don't necessarily work on. No, well, we've been reading texts for the last 150 years, so we have large files, and we have to decide what we base our inclusion policy into the dictionary on a number of citations that we have in the files. And in general, it would be if we've got, say, five examples of a word, then we'll put it forward for potential addition to the dictionary. That's not necessarily a word. It could be a subsense of a word, a meaning of a word, or it could be a phrase or a proverb or a compound. So I guess she isn't, in fact, working on a historical dictionary. She's working on a dictionary of modern Canadian English, so she probably has different criteria than we have. We actually trawl pretty deep, and most words that people, if people come to the OED and visit and say, and I say to them, tell me a new word that you know, and we'll see if we've got any evidence for it. They usually come up with words that were actually current about 10 or 15 years ago originally, and we've had them in the dictionary for a long time. And the most up-to-date ones they may not necessarily know about.
Well, you used the phrase just now, trawling through the literature, which makes me think of a word, and I don't want to put you on the spot here, but there's one word which I have been fascinated by for a long time since an editor in The Guardian told me about it, and that's the word malmarocking, which means the, as I'm sure you know, the carousing of drunken seamen on ice-bound Greenland whaling.
We have to actually change the definition of that in the revised edition of the OED,
right,
slightly. It's one of these words that is picked up, I think, from a 19th century seagoing, or I don't know, I'm not sure what the original text was, but there's one or two references in the 19th century. And it has been picked up as a curious dictionary word. It was defined in the Oxford English Dictionary, and it got into various small dictionaries and was kept in as a curiosity, as some dictionaries do keep words in as curiosities rather than reflecting real usage.
Well, that was my point. I mean, it's a dictionary curiosity rather than a real word, if I can
real
use
word, yes.
What are you looking for nowadays, particularly? The citations, presumably the earliest of an awful lot of computer-type words, are you, like email and web page and so forth?
Yes, I've just been working on the word mail itself, M-A-I-L, and revising the entry since it was first written in about 1904. And obviously at that time they had the postal mail sense. But what's interesting now is how there's variations around the world about over which countries, which varieties of English use mail and which use post. So we had a sort of survey
established. The English use post, of course, and the Americans use mail.
Yes, but what happens in New Zealand and Australia and Canada and South Africa elsewhere. So I emailed a number of dictionary editors on these various continents and these various countries to try to determine who followed the American pattern, who followed the British pattern. And it seemed that most followed the American pattern, but I think New Zealand and South Africa, English-speaking South Africa, tended to use post instead of mail. But now when I think it was about last Tuesday, I added a new entry to the dictionary for mail, meaning email.
Mm-hmm.
What's that film called?
You Have Mail.
You Have Mail, that's right. So then that sort of slightly shifts the whole balance of the word mail, because if people are using it constantly in a computer email context, are they then in Britain and New Zealand and South Africa going to start using mail for post more frequently? And I think we are. I mean, obviously in Britain we still talk about the Royal Mail in fixed collocations, but we use post in ordinary speech. But I tend to talk about mail sometimes now rather than post. It's sort of shifting. I mean, in 20 years' time it may look a completely different picture as well.
A word which has long fascinated me, because I am in one sense a travel writer, is the word travel itself, which came originally, I think, from the Latin tripalium, which was a three-legged instrument that was invented by Nero to torture people, and that eventually got into travail, the French word for work. And when travel, and I'm wanting you to correct me, but I think it all comes from the OED, when travel was first introduced into the English language, it meant something that was hard and difficult. It was work. It wasn't, one never travelled for pleasure. One undertook a travail. And only lately did travel become something associated, as it is today, with pleasure. And it's a very interesting progression from torture to work to pleasure.
Yes, I mean, there are two entries in the OED, one for travail, which is work, or it could mean labour. It could have been the labour of childbirth or any sort of hard work. And there's also the sense of travel, meaning even moving around. And when I get to the letter T, I'll confirm your suspicions.
Do you have a favourite word. And let me preface this once again by saying that when I asked this question of your Canadian colleague, who is not, as you say, doing a historical dictionary, she said, no, all words are equally lovely or equally horrible. And I said that there were some, in my opinion, there were some words which were just ghastly, and I wish they'd never been invented. But on the other hand, words like butterfly and dawn were lovely. Do you have a view?
It's nice that you mentioned the word butterfly, which has got itself rather an unpleasant etymology, probably, which we won't go into. But I was actually going to, I would actually suggest one of the words, a word like macrolepidoptera was one of my favourite words. My favourite word is always the last one I've worked on.
A macrolepidoptera is a big butterfly hunter or a hunter of big butterflies?
Or is it a butterfly hunter with a big net? Yes, no, it's an informal name. It's not a taxonomic name, but it means, it's a collector's name for, large butterflies and moths, the sort of things that you actually might collect if you're a butterfly collector. Now, the curious thing about that word, which I don't think I'd heard of before I came across it in the OED, although if you look on the internet, there are all sorts of examples of the Macrolepidoptera of Borneo, etc., if you want to find them. The curious thing was that the OED, originally, when it included the word in 1904, gave the origin as if it was an English formation from macro and lepidoptera, which both existed in English as words. But nowadays, we're much more conscious that English wasn't necessarily the coiner of these scientific terms, and actually the scientific community throughout Europe and in America might have been using these terms. And looking in online book catalogues, we eventually found an example of the word from an Italian book title from 1851, which was 40 years earlier than the OED had it. And so we've included that information now in the etymology. And the interesting thing for me, really, is that word is typical of evidence that the OED should be looking throughout English and its neighbouring countries. You have to remember that it was a community of scientists, if you like, in the 19th century, and they were swapping words around. And you can't necessarily assume, as the OED originally often did, that a word came from English. It may well have looked like it came in English as an English creation, but actually first started off in, I don't know, Salzburg or Paris or Milan or something like that.
Which brings me to a question that I long to ask you. Are you an English chauvinist, do you think?
Well, I think working on the OED nowadays, you can't be. I mean, that is what I was saying just now about having to recognise that English doesn't create as much as the original OED maybe thought it did, and English is just part of a spectrum of language, if you like. No, it means that you have to look around for. We're looking for influences on English and of English on other countries and other languages, rather than seeing the English language as a sort of monolithic. Pedestal.
But it is a world language now, without a doubt.
Yes, and what does world language mean?
Well, what does it mean?
What does it mean to you? Well, I think that people have two meanings for world English, if you like. One is the idea that there are parts of every standard English around the world that are common and therefore constitute a world English. So if you use that variety of English in America, you'll also be understood elsewhere around the English-speaking world. But also world English people talk about world Englishes, really, which is a recognition that there are varieties of English with their own internal consistency, syntactic and grammatical and lexical consistency in different parts of the world, whether that's in different parts of there will be various varieties of English in America, in Australia, in New Zealand, etc., etc. So, yes, I mean, it does reinforce the idea that English is a world language, but there are different varieties used within that world language.
Tell me, and the CD-ROM is actually a very good tool to use for searching for the kind of question I was wanting to ask you. It is said, wrongly or rightly, I don't know, that in Inuit, in Eskimo languages, there are many, many words for different types of snow. In the English language, is there any particular field that attracts a particularly large number of words?
It's difficult to say. I mean, that's a fallacy about Eskimo languages, I think. So whether there's an equivalent fallacy in English, I don't know. I mean, you'd expect poor old England to have words for different types of rain, drizzle, the haar, the fog, the mist that drifts up the Lincolnshire coastline, etc., etc. So, yes, a mizzle, drizzle, haze. What's the difference between fog and mist, etc., etc.?
So anything to do with gloomy weather there?
Anything to do with gloomy weather, not so much to do with sunny weather, no. It's just, it's a nice day if it's sunny. And I think, I mean, you notice when editing the dictionary that, you do come across quite a few words for, I mean, for example, being drunk, for example. There's a whole thesaurus of words for overindulgence. I suppose, which is seems to be quite common these days. How one manages to differentiate between the different degrees, I don't necessarily know.
But this paints a rather dreadful picture of England as being a land of gloomy weather. Everyone gets drunk all the time.
It is, isn't it? Yes.
But do you, the language and the dictionary, therefore, can almost inadvertently paint a portrait of the society that uses the language.
Well, I think inevitably a dictionary like the Oxford English Dictionary is a historical portrait of a language and a culture and a history. I mean, I don't think I'd be working on the dictionary if it was just a dictionary of definitions. I mean, it's a social history. It's a cultural document.
How has the computer changed the way you do things?
Well, when I first joined the dictionary in 1976, we had, I think, no computers in the department. We were actually quite slow to get into computing because we were near to the end of a long 20-year project. We didn't want to deflect our interests from actually getting that completed. That was the publishing objective. But what happened when we had completed it is that in the 1980s we started to use editorial systems, which allowed us to both define on screen and also to search material in on-screen databases, and that has revolutionized what we do. I mean, a lot of our searching for, if we're working on a word, there are nowadays probably about 20 different major historical databases that we can look into to see if we can find earlier or later examples of the word. In 20 years' time, there are going to be hundreds and hundreds of these databases, and the difficulty will be to know which to look at.
Now, the second edition, the one that came out in 1989, has a CD-ROM version, as you've mentioned. Mm. The third edition, which is due out in 2005, is this, or 2010?
2010.
Is that, are we going to see a hard copy of that, or is
I think we'll inevitably see a hard copy of that, because people want a landmark publication that they can refer back to. But I think before then, you're going to start seeing, revised material becoming available online from the OED, so you won't have to wait until 2010, to see what we're doing at the moment. And what I was talking about earlier about the entry for mail, for example, I mean, I would hope that we'd publish that, in the near future. So people would be able to live along with the story of the English language. It's in the same way that they used to in the 19th century when they used to buy installments of the dictionary as it came out in sections or fascicles, as they used to call it. We won't call them fascicles these days, but there'll be, you know, updates or OED 1.6 or something.
Fascicles. Can we call it a cyber fascicle?
No, we can't.
So you do agree there are some words which are too ugly for inclusion in the language.
I do think cyber words are borderline.
You hate them all, do you?
I wouldn't say hate, but I find them a little bit difficult to use myself. One thing I was wondering about, Simon, was whether you thought your book has made people want to know more about the OED. I mean, has it caused them to go out and buy their own copy of the OED?
Well, I've done quite a lot of signings in the last 9 months or so since the book was published, and a huge number of people have come up to me and said, oh, if only I could afford it, I would buy the dictionary. And, of course, there's been a promotion which enabled people to get it at a considerable reduction. And I understand that, it's a long way of answering your question, I think, yes, it has made people want to buy the OED. And something like 1,500 sets of the 20-volume work have been sold as a pretty direct result of people reading my book. So I'm delighted about that, and we'll see what happens in the future. But if it's rekindled interest in the OED, then you must be rather pleased, I would have thought.
Well, that's terrific, as far as I'm concerned, yes. And if it gives people the idea of going out and buying the CD-ROM, that's terrific, as far as I'm concerned.
Now, finally, if people listening to this want to help in the construction of the third edition of the Oxford English Dictionary and want to search for illustrative quotations, much as W.C. Minor did back in the 1880s, to whom should they write, and how should they submit what they want to submit?
There are two principal ways of submitting material to the OED. I would say that if people do find a word which they think ought to be included in the OED, or they think it might be an earlier example, it is most useful to us if they can first of all find a copy of the OED in their local library and check in that, and not send us material that duplicates what we already have, because editorial staff have a restricted amount of time, and I'd like them to work on editing the dictionary. But certainly, if people have got material to send to us, then they should either send it by email, look at the OED website at oed.com, or send it by post to me, John Simpson, at the Oxford English Dictionary, Oxford University Press, Great Clarendon Street, Oxford, OX26DP in the United Kingdom.
And if they do that enough times, there's a possibility that sometime in the future they'll be summoned to Oxford to be given indifferent
sherry
and meet all their like-minded colleagues.
That's always, well, yes, well, maybe we'll have a virtual party with good sherry.
That would be a splendid idea, John. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. To order additional cassettes or to receive a complete catalog of Harper Audio and Cadman titles, please call us at 1-800-331-3761. That's 1-800-331-3761. Thank you.